it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the Rust Alex Baldwin movie shooting trial
from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Now, back to the courtroom.
Do you swear affirm under penalty of law that the testimony you'll give in this case will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
All right, have a seat, talking to the microphone.
Good morning, sir. Can you please state your name again for the jury?
Scott Elliott.
Mr. Elliott, what do you do for a living currently?
I'm currently a private investigator.
And, Mr. Elliott, prior to becoming a private investigator, did you have a career in law enforcement?
Yes, I did.
Can you tell the jury what your career was in law enforcement, how many years?
Military and civilian, or just...
Let's start with civilian, and we'll work back.
Okay. I was hired by the Albuquerque Police Department, and I attended the academy starting in February of 1993. I retired in 2011. During that time period, I started out field services, normal uniform patrol. I went to the gang unit. Then I became a violent crimes detective in about 1995-96. And in 1998, I became a homicide detective. And I was a homicide detective when I retired in 2011.
So, sir, you spent approximately, it sounds like, 13 years in homicide division?
Part of that was interrupted by post-9/11 deployment, but yes.
Like post-9/11, did you deploy overseas?
I did.
And was that part of your, and we'll get into your military, part of your military duties?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Sir, how many, as part of your homicide portion of your APD employment, approximately how many investigations do you think you worked on in homicide?
As a case agent, 35 or 40, assisting on homicides, 150, 200.
And this is just homicides. You probably had 150, 200. In terms of violent crime or other types of narcotics or any types of, how many investigations do you think you've handled in the course of your police career? Do you even have an estimate?
I don't think so. I became detective in 1995, hundreds of cases a year. And then by the time I was in violent crimes, it was slightly reduced, but that was all violent crime short of homicide. So lots of those.
And you also talked about your military service. Can you tell the jury briefly about whether you had law enforcement type experience with the military?
Yes, I was commissioned in 1981 in the infantry. I spent approximately 10 years on active duty, various duties as part of the active duty time. And then I left the service in active duty in 1992 and 1993, started with the police department. Then I transferred into the reserves. In Albuquerque, there was not an infantry unit anywhere nearby. So I was an engineer officer for a little while, and then I became a secondary specialty of military policeman. And I worked in those functions until I transferred from the Army in 2003 to the Air Force. When I transferred to the Air Force, I took command of what's called a heavy weapons squadron, which is a security forces unit, which is Air Force police. The difference with that unit is that they had weapon systems that are normally found in the Army, mortars, snipers, grenade launchers, things like that. So my prior Army career folded right into that unit and its mission.
So, sir, you've conducted investigations both civilian and military environments. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, and Your Honor, at this time I tender Mr. Elliott as an expert in quality of investigations, law enforcement investigations.
I'm sorry, what was,
are
you
understanding
the first thing you said, Mr. Thompson?
Oh, sure, the quality of law enforcement investigations.
No objection.
All right, he's an expert, as described.
Mr. Elliott, can you tell the jury specifically, what did you do in this particular case? Just an overview scope.
Well, I reviewed all the discovery, all the reports, videos, any documentation, any evidence, that included going and physically looking at the evidence in this case. In addition to that, I interviewed the majority of the state's witnesses in what's called pretrial interviews. I think the only ones I didn't interview were the FBI employees.
Do you recall, ballpark, how many interviews you conducted in this case, just an approximate?
35, 40 maybe.
And in terms of the reports, did you review voluminous reports in this case as well?
Yes, I did.
And have you, as an expert, also made some conclusions based on your review of the materials, your interviews, and what you've seen in this case?
I did.
Okay. I don't want to hit every point that you might make, but I want to hit some of the major ones. First of all, at the scene, at the initial scene when law enforcement responds, can you tell the jury, do you have any conclusions about the quality of the investigation by the sheriffs at the scene?
Yeah, some of that was reached by my own observations and some of it through interviews of the deputies on the scene. I felt like their response was probably not what it should be. There were hundreds of people on that ranch, but if you narrow it down to who was in the church at the time of the shooting and who may have had involvement with the case, for example, the people that were just outside, there was really about 20 people. The first responding deputies, their job is first preservation of life, and then it is preservation of evidence and identifying witnesses and possible suspects. In this case, it was known very quickly who the shooter was, but it wasn't known who the witnesses were. And those witnesses, once they were identified, they should have been segregated so they couldn't talk among themselves.
Now, let me stop you right there. When you initially, as a law enforcement homicide detective or somebody going on scene, you identify the shooter, what in your opinion is one of the first things that you should do?
Well, the first thing you do is put someone with that individual, segregate them from everyone else. You also want to, those individuals, since you are preserving evidence, you also want to secure their cell phones.
Now, in this case, in the materials you reviewed, did it appear to you that Mr. Baldwin was segregated?
Not at all.
And along with the conclusion you just stated, did it appear that his cell phone was taken from him?
No, it was not.
Mr. Elliott, did it appear to you that at any time at the scene that day, Mr. Baldwin was segregated?
He was not.
Okay. Next, you talked about identifying key witnesses and preserving evidence. Can you explain that a little more?
Yes. Well, the scene was secured. You don't often have a scene of that small of an environment. It was known immediately that the shooting occurred inside that church structure and that it probably involved a couple of people just outside near that weapons cart. So that was the immediate concern, that area there. And the deputies, one of the early responding deputies, did get a pretty good list of who was in the church and gave that to the lieutenant. But those individuals were not segregated from everybody else. They were able to mingle with people who were not on scene, who were in a different part of the ranch. Conversations were taking place. People were talking on cell phones. And it's really unknown who they were talking to.
And what is the danger or what is the concern on the part of an investigator when suspects or witnesses are talking?
Well, a couple things. One, people could be getting their story straight. The other is, it causes witnesses to misremember what they did and what they saw. Because in my experience, good, honest citizens try to help. And they'll tell you something that their neighbor told them as if it was there, something that they saw. And it is just human nature that if you talk about something over and over and over again, eventually there are parts of it that you think that you did, and it was what someone else did. So you want a clean, even if it's very brief and they didn't see very much or they didn't hear very much, you want a clean statement of what their knowledge is.
Okay. And with regard to whether, if that is not done, what can that lead to? What is your conclusion about what can happen if people are not segregated and they're allowed to talk to people?
Well, one, you can delete things off your phone. You can delete photos. It wasn't known at the time if somebody was videotaping what was going on inside on their phone. That's possible. Almost every case you work now, someone has videotaped it with their phone.
Did you also determine, and this is another point, but that someone had left the scene and whether that person had been identified?
As far as I know, they still have not been identified.
With regard to securing the prop card on that scene, what is your opinion as to whether that was appropriately handled?
No, it should have remained in place. There was an individual, Brian, was told to go get the cart. He went out of sight behind the church, on the other side of the church, and then he moved the cart around towards the lieutenant's marked unit. That should not have been done.
As well, what is your opinion as to or do you have any concerns about how the evidence on top of the prop cart was handled?
Well, Lieutenant Benavides took possession of the firearm with an ungloved hand, and he grabbed it right around the cylinder. So the largest portion of the revolver is how he picked up the revolver, put it into his vehicle, at another occasion pulled it out of his vehicle and put it back on the cart. He did the same thing with the ammo boxes from the cart. So you definitely can't preserve evidence by touching things with your bare hands, but it also could have damaged anything that was on the boxes or the firearm prior to him handling it.
Now, working our way through this, if, and you may be aware that there was evidence that were rounds thrown away, in the course of your investigation, do you have any concerns at this point with how the police responded to that? The sheriff's responded to that matter?
Well, it's my understanding that they were notified quite late. I think it was a month later. But I didn't see any attempt to go out and see if they were still in the trash at the ranch.
And is that something in your normal investigation, when you were doing homicide investigations, you want to collect all of the potential evidence?
Well, in this case, there's a couple things. The law enforcement was told almost immediately this was the firearm used. But the projectile can't be matched to a firearm. And I know there were at least three 45 Long Colt revolvers on that cart that day. So, although the casing has been tested to match the firearm that was presented to law enforcement, there's no way to know that projectile positively came from that firearm.
Along with the rounds that were thrown away, did you have any other concerns on the follow-up with regard to identifying the source of that live round? Or live rounds that appeared on set?
That didn't seem to be followed up on very strongly. It's a little confusing when rounds came onto the set or the scene, the ranch, and who brought them. It seemed that there were a number of times that, at least one occasion, I thought it was more that Sarah went to PDQ in Albuquerque and brought ammo back. There was the initial ammo provided by PDQ, and then there was some ammo provided by Ms. Gutierrez.
And did you identify any other investigative steps that you think should have been taken to try to further look into the source of the live rounds?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about the white boxes with the JS. That individual has never been interviewed, the producer of the ammunition. So there really was no backtracking of where the ammo came from. You can't say this ammo on the prop cart definitively where it came from. You can't say the ammunition in the prop truck definitively where it came from. There should have been more work done in that area.
And when you're in a situation like this as a former homicide detective, when you're trying to trace the root cause of tragic situation that's occurred, is that something that would be important to you, to find out where the live round originated from?
Yes, this case is also a little unusual in the sense that it wasn't really a whodunit. It was a why done it and how done it. By that I mean you don't know anybody there. You go out as an investigator, you're trying to find out what happened. Was there an argument on set? Was somebody angry? Did somebody have a mental break? Is there some underlying relationship that may have been the root cause of the shooting? You don't know. And that's why an investigation is conducted, to find out those things, and it's also to trace how that firearm came to be where it came to be.
Okay, sir, and with regard to the search of the prop truck that occurred after the 21st, on the 27th, did you have any concerns with the delay in that search warrant?
Oh, absolutely. There were firearms missing from the weapons cart. They had been moved from between the shooting and the arrival of law enforcement. And they were moved into the safe, into the prop truck. That should have been part of an expanding scene. Like I said, you had the church and the area immediately outside of it. But as soon as it became known the prop truck had an involvement with that shooting, the prop truck should have been secured, just like you saw the scene. Crime scene tape, deputy placed there, nobody allowed in the truck until such time as you can do a search warrant.
In addition, with regard to the search warrant of Seth Kenny's business, PDQ Props, did you have any concerns about the delay of approximately a month in searching that business?
Oh, of course. Of course. A delay of a few days could be an issue, but a month is, you could do anything in a month.
And from your review of records in this case, was it ascertainable that Mr. Kenny was one of the suppliers of ammunition to Rust?
I think it was known almost immediately, both by the people at the scene and Mr. Kenny himself.
With respect to that delay in search warrant, there's some obvious things I think that would be apparent to anybody. But why is that an issue? What were the primary issues that you want to do to try to secure a home and search it right away? Secure a business, search it right away. What are the reasons?
Well, it's preservation of evidence. If no one can get inside the business, then no one can tamper with anything that's inside. And you hope to get everything as it was as soon as you can, without any type of alteration.
With regard to Mr. Kenny, did you also have any concerns about collection of DNA, fingerprints, things like that?
I did. Those things can be used for elimination or positively identifying someone. In the case of Mr. Kenny, if they had his major case prints and had his DNA, and none of it was found on the boxes of ammunition, then it would eliminate him as somebody possibly being involved.
In your opinion, in your experience as an investigator, would this have been something that you would expect to have been done, that the supplier of ammunition to Rust, that he would also be looked at in that respect?
Yes, considering the environment and the fact that there should not have been live rounds on set.
Now, with regard to Mr. Kinney, did you also determine whether his phone had been seized to be extracted or whether that had been fully extracted?
It was not. His phone was never.
What is your opinion on that potential or that fact that his phone was never taken for extraction?
The contact between Sarah Zachary and he almost immediately after the shooting warranted that.
And are you speaking about the phone call right after the shooting where we heard testimony and there was a text emergency? Is that the time frame you're talking about?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And are you also aware that there were a number of calls that Seth Kinney, other calls he was making in contact with Sarah Zachary?
Dozens of calls.
In your opinion, to do a complete investigation, to get the facts out, to get the truth on the table, was that something that you would expect to be done, that they fully investigate Seth Kinney?
Objection.
Sir, would you have expected, in your experience as a homicide detective, a full investigation of Mr. Kinney?
Yes, especially considering that Sarah Zachary worked for him.
Did you also have any concerns about the failure to obtain Mr. Baldwin's phone early on and what happened after that?
As I stated before, that would have been an immediate. Every deputy should have known that as soon as he was identified as being the shooter. And then my understanding is that he left the state with it, and that forensic analysis was done in New York. I should correct myself. The extraction was done in New York.
And do you have any knowledge of whether all of the contents were obtained off of Mr. Baldwin's phone?
I have no way of knowing that.
We talked about the scene, some search warrants. We talked about phones, fingerprints, DNA. Did you have any other opinions or concerns about the quality of this investigation?
One aspect of it that's still kind of a mystery to me is when the lieutenant arrived on the scene, first two things he asked for was the gun and the armor. I thought that was a little unusual. He didn't seem to be the least concerned of who the shooter was and what that individual's status was. He placed Ms. Catetas into his marked unit, which is pretty common, also considering that, you know, she had some anxiety issues and so on. But it immediately became clear she was not free to leave. Whenever the lieutenant would leave his vehicle, he'd tell the deputy to keep an eye on her. When Detective Hancock got to the scene, she almost immediately took charge of Hannah, to include going to the bathroom with her. So she clearly was not free to leave. Every other individual on that ranch was free to walk around, talk to anyone, talk on their phone, do anything they wanted to do. Except Ms. Cortez.
Now, you talked about some anxiety and this situation. In your experience, do you have any concerns about interviewing someone in the immediate aftermath of a traumatic situation?
Objection.
Mr. Elliott, in the course of your career in both civilian and military law enforcement, have you encountered situations where people have been interviewed in traumatic situations?
Yes, I have.
And have you personally been involved in that?
I have.
And can you tell the jury, do you have any concerns regarding interviewing an individual right after a traumatic situation?
Yes. Probably would have started with an EMT or a paramedic checking her to see if she was okay, see what her status was health-wise, whether she was having, you know, hyperventilating or whatever symptoms or anxiety had, to make sure she was okay that way. Because of confessions and the way those things can go, you're extra careful to make sure that someone is not in a state that can later be determined not to be a good mental state, and all your work in that confession or that statement is not admissible. So you try to avoid that if you can.
And you said that you would have that person looked at in those situations by an EMT or a medical?
Yes.
What is the purpose of that again?
Again, it's just to make sure that she's in a state where she can, or the individual's in a state where they can talk to you. You want them to be as accurate as they can also. So if that causes a little bit of a delay before you can interview them, and they're still willing to be interviewed, you may get a more accurate statement from them.
Okay. Thank you. And any other concerns about this investigation that we haven't hit on, Mr. Elliott? You may have stated them all. I just wanted to ask if there was anything else.
I don't think so.
Okay. I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Cross-exam.
Mr. Elliott, isn't it true that you are the defense investigator on this case?
It's true.
You work for Mr. Bowles and Ms. Gutierrez, and they are paying you.
That's correct.
And as a person who is employed as the defense investigator, it is your job to aid in her defense. Isn't that true?
That's true.
Now, you seem to take issue with the fact that Lieutenant Benavidez touched the firearm with his ungloved hand. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
But you agree with me that, unlike a lot of homicides or shootings, this one occurred in the presence of upwards of a dozen people.
That's true.
So there was not going to be any mystery as to who had the gun and who pulled the trigger, correct?
To that aspect, no.
You seem to take issue with the fact that the projectile in this case can't be matched to the firearm, right?
Only in the sense that to confirm that the firearm presented to law enforcement was the actual firearm. It doesn't really change what happened.
But where's the controversy? What do you have some information that the jury hasn't heard that the gun that was fired by Mr. Baldwin is actually not the gun that was used? I haven't come across that. Have you?
No, I was referring to when the officers arrived at the scene, they didn't know that other than what one person told them.
Okay, but it turned out to be true. There's no controversy. The gun that was used in the shooting is the gun that was in Mr. Baldwin's hand, right?
True.
Okay. And the reason that the projectile can't be matched to the firearm is because the projectile went through two people, and it was so heavily damaged because it went through two human beings, there wasn't enough marking to match it to the bore of the gun. Isn't that true?
That's true.
Now, in terms of fingerprints and DNA on the ammunition box. Sir, did you watch the video where Ms. Gutierrez actually says to Mr. Benavidez, "This is the box I was pulling from"?
Yes, I did.
And that box is taken and put into Mr. Benavidez's patrol unit, correct?
The lieutenant placed it in his vehicle, yes.
Right. So where's the controversy in terms of what box she was pulling from?
Part of it was to find where the live ammo originated. That information may have been on the outside of the box. Could have had Seth Kenny's DNA, could have had Seth Kenny's fingerprints, or anyone else where the box came from originally.
But, sir, didn't you watch the second interview with Ms. Gutierrez where she actually held up a photograph for Corporal Hancock and said, this is a picture of our boxes of dummies, and not coincidentally, it matched identically to the box that she identified as the box that she was pulling rounds from that day. You watched that interview, didn't you?
By 1:30. Please don't talk among yourselves or anyone else about the evidence received here in court. Thank you.
All rise.
All right, you may be seated.
Excuse me. All right, Mr. Elliott, I want to just back up for a brief moment, and I want to go back to any concerns you had about the projectile not matching the gun. I'm not sure that I fully understand what your concerns are in that regard. Would you articulate them for us again?
Yes, I was referring to the concerns that a detective would have upon arriving at scene. You don't have at the time, the results of lab testing. So, and you have nothing guaranteed.
What do you mean, nothing guaranteed?
Well, at the time, you had some people saying, this is the gun. But you didn't have any evidence, scientific evidence, showed that was the gun, which was later found to be true. I'm just talking about, you have so many variables and so many unknowns that you can only use interviews on the scene to confirm and deny things. One person saying, this is the gun, that may very well be the gun. But you have to see if someone else can verify that. You know, later on, you're going to have lab results, not at the time. And that's what I was referring to, is at the time, at the scene on October 21st.
So what's your concern, then, about the investigation that the Sheriff's Department did with regard to the gun? Is your testimony that after Ms. Gutierrez identified the gun to Lieutenant Benavidez and handed him the gun, there should have been more follow-up with regard to whether or not that was really the gun? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, because she's not the one that handed the gun to Mr. Baldwin. There are people in between that process. So
continue, sir. I apologize.
All right. Again, pieces of information come out as they're going through both processing the scene and interviewing people. And now we know that there is some time delay between the firearm being loaded, the firearm being on the cart, the firearm making it to Mr. Baldwin inside the church. And that's what I meant by the investigation at the time. A lot of information is coming out over months. Some information has come much later.
But you agree with me that Ms. Gutierrez handed Lieutenant Benavidez the gun and said, this is the gun that was being used. And when she said that, she had been identified as the armorer on the movie set. You agree with that?
I do.
And you also agree that, not surprisingly, that turned out to be the gun. You agree with that?
Oh, I do, yes.
So any potential issues with regard to that specific concern of yours didn't turn out to be issues. We don't. There's no issue. You agree with that. This is the gun. This is the gun that fired that projectile.
Correct, yes.
Okay. When we left off, there was an objection, and I'm going to go through with you. You were talking about the ammo boxes. I think that was where the objection was. So, as the investigator in this case, have you reviewed all of the body-worn camera footage?
I have. There's a lot.
So have I.
Yes.
I'm sympathetic to the exhausted look on your face. I'm going to show you what has been marked as what is already in evidence as State's Exhibit 192. Sir, have you seen this exhibit?
I have.
Do you agree with me that this is Lieutenant Benavides is pointing to the box that Ms. Gutierrez identified as the box that she was pulling ammunition from? Do you agree with that?
He is pointing to a box of ammunition, yes.
Are you indicating that you believe that the box here in this picture was not the box that she was pulling ammunition from?
No, I'm not. There were two boxes, and I don't know if it was clearly delineated to him which of the two boxes was where the ammo was drawn from.
Well, you understood that the gun was loaded with dummies or was supposed to be loaded with dummies at the time of the incident, right?
Right.
And you also understand that this was the only box of dummies on the cart. You understand that, right?
Yes.
The other boxes were blanks, correct?
Correct.
And Ms. Gutierrez said to Lieutenant Benavides, this is the box I was pulling from, right?
Yes.
You don't think that Ms. Gutierrez meant to say I was pulling from a box of blanks when the gun was loaded with supposed dummies, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay. State's Exhibit 62. Have you seen this photo?
I probably have hundreds of photos of white boxes, but I can't
that
specifically say this photo.
Does the box on the left, does that label look familiar to you in your investigation in this case?
It does.
So, based on your investigation, do you have any reason to believe that the box that Ms. Gutierrez pointed out to Lieutenant Benavides is not this box that he took and placed in his unit?
I do not. And I believe that photo is taken in the unit, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I can see the seat.
State's Exhibit 63. You understand that this is a photo of that exact same box when it was taken into evidence at the Sheriff's Department, right?
Yes, that's how how it's labeled, yes.
I'm not asking how it's labeled. You've reviewed the evidence at the evidence room, right?
Yes.
And you've reviewed all the photographs that were taken on scene.
Yes.
Let me ask you, isn't it true that there was only one box found with this label? Isn't that correct?
That I don't know.
You're the defense investigator on this case, right?
Yes.
Have you seen photographs of a box that looks like this, but is loaded with something other than what this box was loaded with? Do you have any reason to believe that there were two boxes with this label that were taken into evidence?
I do not know.
State's Exhibit 69. Have you seen this photo?
Again, I've seen dozens of photos. So.
Well, you're here to give an opinion about the investigation on this case. Are you not familiar with this photograph?
Specifically, no.
Okay. Did you watch the interview in November that Ms. Gutierrez gave to Detective Hancock?
I did.
And do you recall during that interview, Ms. Gutierrez holds up her phone and says, "This is a picture of our dummies," meaning the dummies that she would bring on the set. Do you recall that?
I do recall that, yes.
Isn't this the photo that she showed? You don't know?
Not at this point, no.
Okay. You weren't watching the testimony of our expert, Mr. Hawks, when he laid the foundation for this and indicated that this photograph was sent from a contact in her phone named Dad Kula to her the day before the interview with Detective Hancock. Were you not aware of that?
I was not, no.
So, sir, based on Ms. Gutierrez's statements, would it be her own statements to law enforcement, would it be reasonable for law enforcement to believe that State's Exhibit 62, this box here in the foreground, is indeed the box she was pulling from because she said that? Wouldn't that be reasonable for law enforcement to believe that?
Yes, it would.
And you understand that that box was determined to have a live round?
Yes.
And you agree with me that that box that had the live round matches this photo that was shown to Detective Hancock during the November 9th interview? You understand that?
Yes, I do.
Sir, do you still have questions and concerns about how the live rounds got on set?
I do.
You don't think that law enforcement can simply take Ms. Gutierrez's word for it, that this is her box and this is the one she was pulling from and this is the one where live rounds were found?
Yes, but what we don't know is how many times those boxes were unloaded and reloaded. Every time that one of the firearms were loaded with dummy rounds, they came out of a box. They didn't necessarily go back into the same box.
Do you agree with me, sir, that there are certain things in homicide investigations that just simply can't be controlled for? You agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Sir, what's the smallest police department you've ever worked for?
Albuquerque PD.
You agree with me that the Albuquerque Police Department is approximately 10 times the size of the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Department with regard to the number of commissioned officers?
I am. I think Albuquerque is around 850, and I think Santa Fe is 120, 130, something like that.
Okay. More than 8 times.
Right.
You agree with that math?
I do.
Have you ever worked on a homicide investigation on a movie set?
I have not.
Do you agree with me that normally in homicide investigations, police aren't concerned with where the live ammo came from? This case is unique in that regard, isn't it?
This case is unique from the beginning, yes.
Okay, it is,
yes.
Right? It's
mm-hmm.
unique from the beginning. So, police officers, you would agree, are not trained in how to investigate homicides on movie sets where they're not supposed to have live rounds, they're supposed to have fake rounds. Cops aren't trained in that, right?
Specifically, no.
Okay. And you agree with me, don't you, that Lieutenant Benavidez can't just let Ms. Gutierrez walk around the movie set with a firearm that appears to have just shot two people. You agree with that?
Well, I do agree with that with reference to firearm, yes.
Yeah. It was incumbent on Lieutenant Benavidez to remove that firearm from her possession, correct?
From anyone's possession, yes.
And you just take issue with the fact that he didn't put a glove on before he did it?
Basically, yes.
But you agree that the fact that he didn't put a glove on didn't turn out to create any significant evidentiary issues in this case because everybody knew who was holding the gun and everybody knew who shot the gun. You agree with that?
I do.
And, sir, you also agree with me, don't you, that a police officer's first responsibility is to save human lives, not collect evidence?
Correct, as I stated, yes.
And do you recall that Ms. Gutierrez was actually checked by EMTs when she was sitting in the back of Lieutenant Benavidez's patrol unit?
Yes, I did see that.
And you agree that she was allowed to make phone calls?
Yes, she was.
I think you indicated that you talked a little bit about that Detective Hancock sort of took possession of Ms. Gutierrez. Do you recall the statement that you made in that regard?
I do.
So I want to ask you. And one of the examples you gave was that Detective Hancock even accompanied Ms. Gutierrez to the restroom, right?
Yes, she did.
But in watching the body-worn camera footage, isn't it true that Sergeant Christopher Zook tells Detective Hancock, she doesn't want to go to the bathroom alone, will you take her to the bathroom? Ms. Gutierrez actually asks to be accompanied to the bathroom. Do you recall that?
I do.
And do you agree with me that it was Ms. Gutierrez who asked to be placed in Detective Hancock's patrol unit? That wasn't something that the police just unilaterally did with her.
No, she did. She did ask.
Is there a problem with them granting her request that she be accompanied to the bathroom?
No, but I didn't think that included going into the bathroom with her. Can I elaborate?
Sure.
I believe she stated something along the lines of she didn't want to talk to anyone from production. So it's kind of like if she was with Detective Hancock, she wouldn't be approached by any of her coworkers. I think that was her intention of being escorted. But I didn't think it included going into the bathroom itself.
Well, she went into the bathroom and she had her back turned to Ms. Gutierrez. What's the big deal? Ms. Gutierrez asked for an escort. What? How did that hurt the investigation?
Hurt the investigation?
Yeah.
It did not.
Now, Ms. Gutierrez stayed on set, and she was sitting in a police car with the door open, and there was a co-worker of hers sitting in there visiting with her. You agree with that?
Yes, I do.
And she had her phone. You agree with that?
Yes.
She was allowed to make phone calls.
Yes.
She was never placed in handcuffs. You agree with that?
Correct.
So what's problematic about that? How was she mistreated by police?
I didn't say she was mistreated. It's all every appearance of not being free to leave. I based that on the fact that when Lieutenant Benavidez would step away from his vehicle, he would tell a deputy to keep an eye on her. If she's free to leave and she's just sitting in the back of the unit with an open door. She should be allowed to walk away if she wanted to. It gives the impression that she is in custody when you're not free from constant observation from law enforcement.
Well, but isn't it true that she seemed to be having a panic attack and it was appropriate for Lieutenant Benavides, when he walked away, to ask another officer to keep an eye on her, to make sure she's okay? Isn't that true?
At that time, she appeared fine.
Did she? Is that a yes?
That's a yes.
So, was it your expectation that Mr. Baldwin should have been detained? Do you believe that they should have detained him?
I do.
And do you believe that they should have put him in a police car and taken his phone away?
Not necessarily placed in a police car, but he should have been segregated from the other witnesses, and his phone should have been taken to preserve evidence.
Don't you agree with me that there has to be probable cause that there may be evidence on the phone before the phone can be taken?
But they wouldn't know if there was going to be evidence on the phone without interviewing him. There was no other way to know whether there was evidence on that phone or not. But he was on the phone when law enforcement arrived. So who was he talking to?
Well, did you look at his call logs?
That's after the fact. I'm talking about when deputies arrived at the scene.
Okay, I appreciate that. But what I'm trying to figure out is, what about your concerns actually turned out to be real issues with the investigation? What evidence was missing or hidden by Mr. Baldwin? What evidence do you have?
We don't have the full contents of his phone.
Has the defense filed any kind of a motion in this case to try to get the full contents of his phone?
That I don't know.
And you understand, though, that a full extraction of Mr. Baldwin's phone was done in New York, but we were given a limited report. You understand that?
Yes, I do.
And you also understand that originally the same thing happened with Ms. Gutierrez. A limited report was generated from a full extraction, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you agree with me that defense counsel is free to issue subpoenas and file motions to compel and do all of those things in a case if they feel that they're missing evidence?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
So do you think that it would have been appropriate then for law enforcement to take Ms. Gutierrez's phone away from her and not let her make a phone call to her mother?
That can be monitored also. I've seen it done both ways. I've seen them taken away where they're not allowed to make any phone calls, and I've also seen where they've been able to make a call in the presence of law enforcement.
Sir, generally, in your experience as a law enforcement officer, do you usually continue to investigate an individual for a crime after you have, let's say, for months, after you have been unable to develop a single lead that person was involved? Do you need me to rephrase that question?
I think I understand your question. You're saying, do you continue an investigation of someone that has... You have no information.
Yeah, right. You looked, you executed a search warrant, you interviewed the person numerous times, and you just simply don't have any evidence that they were involved. At some point, don't they just not become a suspect anymore?
I don't know if that's the correct phrase, but your investigation is over. You've taken the investigation as far as you can go.
Right. So at some point with Mr. Kinney, they executed a search warrant, they interviewed him numerous times, and they didn't come up with anything. So what do you think they should have done to continue?
At that point, there wasn't much further they could go.
And, sir, are you aware that the FBI will not do DNA testing on rounds, whether they're spent or unspent? Were you aware of that?
I heard about it in this case. But they have done DNA testing on casings, unspent casings.
Well, weren't you present? Were you present for a pretrial interview of the DNA expert in this case?
I was.
And you heard her during the interview state that they won't do this kind of DNA testing, correct?
I did.
All right. And you agree with me, sir, that police officers, when they arrived on scene, they knew immediately who the shooter was.
I think that information arrived shortly after the first deputies arrived, but it was before the lieutenant arrived. There's a little lag there, but not much time at all.
Okay, and Mr. Baldwin didn't leave the scene, did he?
He did not.
You testified on direct examination that there was a person who left the scene that was never identified. Do you recall making that statement?
I did, and that was based on what came out of some of the interviews. I don't quite recall. I think the lieutenant asked if we had everybody. And
what lieutenant are you talking about?
Lieutenant Benavides.
Okay.
And one of the deputies responded with, "One left." And I think he asked who that was, and the deputy didn't know.
But you know, don't you? Because you interviewed him and you asked him. Didn't you interview Reed Russell? And when you interviewed Reed Russell, he told you that he left so that he could go to the hospital to be with his close friends. And before he left, he gave all of his contact information to the police. You interviewed him. Do you recall that?
I did.
Do you need to see a copy of the interview?
I don't.
And you also understand that Mr. Russell, who left the scene to go to the hospital, was interviewed the very next day by Detective Cano. Aren't you aware of that?
I am, yes.
So what's the mystery? Who's the mystery man that left the set? He was identified, right? Correct?
Mr. Russell was identified, but I was never quite clear if it was the same individual.
Even though you asked him and he said, "I'm the guy that left the set to go to the hospital"?
Yes, but did he know he was the only one who left?
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. I'll pass the witness.
Redirect.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Elliott, you're aware from all your experience in law enforcement that it is the government's burden to prove in any criminal case, correct? And that burden never shifts to the defendant.
That's correct, yes.
So when you were asked earlier about why the defense didn't file motions and do subpoenas, isn't that law enforcement and the government's job to prove their case?
Objection.
Mr. Elliott, do you recall that question?
I do.
Okay, and is it always the government's burden to prove their case, to prove in a criminal case?
It is.
Okay. Now, if law enforcement doesn't timely and appropriately obtain evidence, does that sometimes impact an entire investigation?
It can.
For example, in your experience as a homicide detective and working in civilian and military law enforcement, if you delay a search warrant for a month, can that materially impact a case?
It can.
And in your experience, have you seen times when there's been that kind of delay where evidence goes missing?
I have.
You talked earlier about the FBI and other cases you had been aware of where they had obtained DNA. You did not expand on that. Have you been aware of other cases in which the FBI has searched for DNA on casings?
The Las Vegas shooting.
So based on that answer, is it your understanding they do have the capacity, the ability to do that?
They do have the ability, yes.
Earlier you were asked a series of questions about, I'm going to categorize them as no harm, no foul. In other words, we know in hindsight now that certain things didn't happen. But in any case, homicide investigation, would you always want to start out assuming that anything can go wrong and to properly preserve that evidence?
Yes, of course.
For example, with regard to the firearm, when you testified about Lieutenant Benavides touching that firearm, would there be scenarios, not like it played out here, but where somebody else turned out to be the shooter, for example, and that firearm, it was important to know the fingerprints?
Well, of course. This investigation started with a 911 call. They are not always accurate.
And so I guess my point, my question to you is, in your experience, in your training, and 13 years as homicide, were you taught and trained to preserve evidence and to take those appropriate steps in every single case?
Yes.
We were asked earlier a series of questions about Ms. Gutierrez-Reed and whether she was there voluntarily or the appearance of being detained. Did the sheriffs drive Ms. Gutierrez-Reed to the sheriff's office?
Yes, they did.
Did they drive Mr. Baldwin to the sheriff's office?
No, he drove himself and followed a deputy.
Okay. From the time that Ms. Gutierrez-Reed was in the vehicle on the set to the time of the interview, did you ever notice any period of time when she was not in law enforcement presence?
I did not.
With regard to the questions about items and boxes on the prop cart, as you were asked, the two boxes, is it clear to you from reading the reports, everything that you reviewed in this case, what items Sarah and the other two individuals may have removed from the prop cart and taken to the prop truck?
No, it is not clear to me.
And based on your entire review of the whole case, has there ever been any follow-up or any information you've received that would have clarified that, what they took from the prop cart?
No, a vague couple long guns. I think two revolvers, they do know who they came from. And other items that I don't know of.
One last question. If law enforcement delays, if they do not conduct a full investigation, is it possible for the defense to lose out on evidence that may have been exculpatory?
Yes, there is.
Then I have no further questions.
You're excused. Thank you. Next witness.
Your Honor, we call Frank Kuski.
More raw courtroom audio from the Rust Alex Baldwin movie shooting trial is on the way.
Press subscribe so you don't miss a moment.
From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at chumbacasino.com.
By law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.